So what is the public mood on the National Health Service? Impatient, dissatisfied and polarised? Or rock solid and sympathetic? And what might this mean going into the future, particularly as political currents are so polarised and so dynamic? So with me to discuss this, I'm very delighted to have Rachel Wolfe, who is the CEO of Public First, a public research agency. I wonder whether you could just kick us off by saying, from your perspective, how would you characterise the public mood in the UK today? And what, if anything, has changed?
The public mood is unsurprisingly very grim. Has been very grim for some time, certainly since Liz Truss and her collapse, then the very rapid dissatisfaction with Rishi, and then very soon after Starmer came in, there have been, for almost all that period, very high public anger, lack of trust in politics, lack of trust that things will improve for the better. What I think has happened, though, is that we've had a lot of cycles of politicians or political campaigns promising change, and from the public's point of view, not only failing to deliver, but not even really trying to deliver. That started with Brexit, both the fighting over whether Brexit would be delivered at all, but also the very large rise in immigration post-Brexit. Then the 2019 Conservative campaign, which was another change campaign, and then the rapid hit of COVID, and then energy prices, and then all the scandals, which led to, again, political anger, and still immigration was rising. Then Liz Truss's catastrophe, then Rishi Sunak coming in, promising he would stop the boats, halve inflation, cut waiting lists, and then finally Keir Starmer promising change in the election, and things still feeling like they are getting worse, not better. With each of those phases, what you see is an uptick in political mistrust, in anger from parts of the population, disengagement from some parts of the population. And I think now the move towards reform and Greens is, well, everyone else has so visibly failed, you might as well let them have a go. And they at least seem to be sort of serious and cutting through and saying clear things about what they would do differently.
And how far is this mistrust and rage directed against institutions that we know and love rather than just the political establishment, do you think?
I think that if you forced a choice between politicians and institutions would still win. But you have unquestionably seen declining trust in some of the core institutions like the BBC. We have seen increases in people who are dissatisfied with the way in which the NHS is run. Nuffield Trust published their most recent stuff based on the NatSen BSA survey data on this, and it does look like dissatisfaction with the NHS is rising. You see higher percentages of people who mistrust all the core kind of professions and institutional professions, law, journalism, etc. So I don't think it is as bad, but you are seeing less faith in our institutions to deliver.
And just on the BSA, I mean, the question there is, how satisfied are you in the way, quote, the NHS is run nowadays, unquote? I assume it's more directed against political establishment. But if you look at the bigger surveys, which is the patient survey, satisfaction once people get NHS care is actually quite high, or at least it's much higher than the BSA would indicate. That still means that access could be a problem. Just back to the rage and the burn it down group, of which are infecting quite a number of people in the UK. How do you think this is going to play out? It's clearly at the moment located on Reform UK as being a hope, it seems, in the polls. But as I was discussing with Luke, the people who are supporting reform or who are reform warm are actually quite a big chunk of almost half the population, it seems. Is that your understanding too?
Reform is not a fringe phenomenon, not close. And there are certainly parts of what reforms stand for on migration, on some parts of welfare that you get very, very significant support among the public for. One thing I would say, though, is before the 2024 election, I think there was a debate about whether Keir Starmer's victory was because Labour was really popular or because people really hated the Conservatives so much they would vote for anyone to get rid of them. And I think it's fairly clear that the vote for Labour was a negative vote. It was a vote against the Conservatives. And that's one of the reasons they've struggled so much, because they didn't have a real mandate to change anything. I think the same is largely true for reform. What people are voting for is change from, rather than feeling a huge swing of enthusiasm.
And if you look at institutions that need to change, like the NHS and indeed others, I mean, there's lots of things that need to be done that take a while, investments, the planning decisions and so on. It's actually quite tricky to show what can be done in the short term, other than one or two important things like waiting lists. How do we get through to the population that this is what's needed, that actually only a few things can change very, very quickly? Or is it just an impossibility and you just have to decide to prioritise the short-term things, even if it's the expense of the long-term health of the institution?
I don't think it is an impossibility. So I put much less blame on the electorate for what's happening than I think many other people do. I don't think there has been a political campaign that's seriously set out credible dividing lines for probably over a decade now. 2015 did, and Brexit, I suppose, did. What has instead tended to happen is we've had political campaigns where we have promised the electorate that actually it's relatively easy to fix these problems, that we don't need to change anything radical or make any very hard choices to do so, elided over the kinds of really, really hard trade-offs facing the country. How much are we willing to pay for our NHS? If NHS spending requires more than real terms growth to stay still, are we willing to do that? No one is having that debate or discussion. So I don't think it's impossible to have a serious conversation with the electorate. I think, though, the challenge is that in order to be able to have those conversations, you have to do something to show you're serious. I have always been a very big fan of this broken windows theory of politics, which is there are small things you can do very rapidly in the public realm, on crime, on waiting lists and GPs that demonstrate you are capable of getting something, anything done and build momentum. Then you have the opportunity to have a long-term argument. I definitely do think we've fallen into a trap in politics and policy recently where we have used opinion polling and focus groups in a very short-term and poor way. And we have just asked through polls and focus groups, you know, what do people think? And then reflected that back and not thought enough about what causes public opinion to change. Public opinion does change. And it is possible to both have an argument and make policy shifts that in turn persuade the electorate that something is required.
If that's what you're thinking, let's just sort of translate that into what could be a reform UK government. It's going to face these really hard trade-offs. It's going to have to show some short-term benefits. What do you think they will be? Have you got any idea, including whether they support an NHS? And the more recent dialogue has been to support the NHS, from what I've heard. Have you got any closer to what you think the party might be thinking of with respect to the NHS?
Reform's weakest area is almost certainly the NHS. My guess is that when we get to a serious election between Reform and some group of left-wing progressive parties, the attack on Reform will be, you are planning to sell off our NHS, you are planning to privatise our NHS, you are planning to make NHS American, because that is always the attack on right-wing parties, and it's particularly potent for Reform. So I think it is very likely they will continue to be more emollient. I also think it is very likely that they will go on a very big tear on NHS and immigration and on NHS and waste. It will probably be reform within those bounds. And then they will try very hard for it not to be the thing they fight the campaign on. So if they can, they'll demonstrate their basic support for the NHS, because that is a risk for them with their electorate. They will try very hard to make the core focus a judgment on the competence of the mainstream parties on immigration and potentially on welfare. If they must talk about the NHS other than basically supporting it, it will be on waste and immigration.
And what line then do you think they will take on the NHS and immigration, given the fact that so many workers in the NHS, for which there's enormous vacancies, as we know, are in fact foreign trained and foreign born?
So whenever I've looked at this purely on a polling point of view, the most popular NHS policy is always something to do with charging migrants more. So that is always extremely popular. There will, I suspect, be a big push on training British doctors, nurses, increasing that. I would be astonished if they said, we're going to chuck out all of the migrants who are currently nurses and doctors. I don't think they're going to do that. But they are going to say that migration is a burden on the NHS.
So do you think then, given the demographic that is likely to be drawn to reform, that really they don't or are unlikely to really significantly change the NHS model, other than perhaps being more muscular or apparently muscular on waste and immigration?
Look, the first thing I should say is we don't know what's going to happen. We are in an incredibly volatile economic and political period globally. And in very volatile economic and political periods, things that seemed completely unassailable, such as the basic post-war global model, suddenly start to look like they're going to crumble. If we, for example, had two more pandemics with our current debt to GDP ratio, would it require us to behave fundamentally differently than we did in the last pandemic? Probably. If we go for serious global trade war or even war, will it change what is possible for this country, because we will have to radically increase our defense budget overnight, possibly. So I know this is maybe not helpful, but I think we must recognize that the next 20 years, I haven't even got to AI and technology, is likely to be of a volatility that we're not familiar with in the post-World War II era, and it makes all models vulnerable. But if you see one of those things happen, then yes, my guess is they will stick with, in some way, the idea of NHS free at the point of use. Although, as you will know, that's something everybody agrees to in principle. What it means in the details is often a little more malleable than that basic idea.
Clearly, Reform UK, we're focusing on them because they're obviously quite a significant challenger party. They haven't yet revealed their policies on the National Health Service, but I understand they're working closely on them at the moment. And someone who's helping advise, James Orr from the Centre for Better Britain, when asked how to encapsulate the ideology that you're using, he used the terms conservative nationalism. And I think he was referring to their economic policy. But the nationalism, there's nothing more national than the National Health Service, is there? And conservatism at least indicates the preservation of an institution. Doesn't mean to say you can't rip up bits of it. So it looked to me as if they are going to follow that kind of line, which speaks to the voters, then that is at least something that might preserve something like the NHS model.
It is probably worth knowing that for many politicians and political thinkers on the right, they loathe the fact that the NHS is what's often called our national religion. They think that we made a terrible mistake in not moving to a European insurance model, and that this is something they have to grit their teeth and bear about the electorate rather than something they like about the electorate. I'm quite sure that for many people in reform, if they could wave a magic wand and move to a more German or French system tomorrow, they would do so.
Although I don't know if you saw the policy exchange report that came out last year, and actually I had Savid Javid, who wrote the foreword to that report, on the podcast. They were suggesting a move to a social insurance, just as you say, but the Dutch model, but conveniently forgetting that it costs a great deal more than our system, including tax money, but not central income tax, which was the issue. It's a tax on employers and so on, if listeners want to re-listen to that. But I didn't find the arguments that convincing for certainly a model that was cheaper and better. I think that is the model that they maybe have in their head.
One of the openings for NHS reform conversations right now is that we are having this struggle post-COVID that it's not completely clear we're recovering from in terms of productivity and output of the NHS, and a sense that our system has increased its funding quite significantly, but it doesn't feel quite as efficient as it did. That makes it easier to have these kinds of arguments again.
I think looking at the state of the COVID injury on the population and indeed the health service, that was very high in this country, as you know, when you look at the figures. And we haven't bounced back as quickly, but we are improving. That's what the latest figures show. Small dents, as you see in the waiting list, but actually improving productivity over time, still a long way to go. So it's more injured and slower response, but there is a response. And some of the ability, I guess, for the service to respond depends on its previous investments, how strong some of the basic building blocks, capital, equipment, staff, all that. And if that has been injured as well, then of course it would take longer to come back. And I think that helps to explain why the improvement, while there, is slower in coming, I think.
You are very reasonably and rationally defending all of the possible attacks or even points that politicians might make on the NHS and merely saying that the changes just make it more possible to make those arguments whether people get fair or not. And I think the other thing that we have to bear in mind over the next period, so into the next election, is we do have three fundamental challenges. Number one is that the demand on NHS spending for demographics and various other reasons is greater than our growth rates. That makes it difficult to sustain in perpetuity, or at least it's a difficult conversation. The second is that over the last several decades, one of the ways in which we have funded increases in public services is through decreases in our defense budget. And that is plausibly going to come under more pressure. And the third, of course, is migration, because if we are going to be entering into a period of very low net migration, then that has, as you've pointed out, consequences on the costs of some of these services, certainly in terms of staff. So I think there are lots of reasons to assume that the debate on NHS, certainly spending and funding, if not its core model, will become more and more difficult over the next decade. And that will change how politicians talk about it.
So the speed of change is the issue at point here, and that we will be overtaken by events unless we speed up the level of reform, which means not just the short-term things that we think that politicians will have to focus on for the reasons you clearly set out, but actually some longer-term building blocks. But the question is, how do you get the sophisticated conversation into voters' minds that both of these things are needed, not just the short-term things? So how do you change that flywheel of discussion that is amplified, particularly in the media and social media?
I have a really glib and annoying answer, which is I don't think anyone's tried yet.
Well, they haven't, I suppose. But I guess, as you say, people are disposed to hearing that if they feel as if they trust and admire and respect. And there's some politicians and there's some immediate short-term change. It's a loop, isn't it, that? Perhaps just turn to health for a minute. Again, I'm focusing on Reform UK. You might automatically think that Reform UK would be fairly light on its public health messages. But in a sense, that is one of the big building blocks we have to change, particularly on obesity. Do you see the public mood being at odds at all with the beer-swilling, cigarette-smoking brigade?
MAHA, which is the sort of great movement of Trump, which is very different from the fairly libertarian, non-nanny state attitude of Nigel Farage, and is quite worrying in some ways. Some of the anti-vax stuff is really quite worrying, but is also obsessive about good diets. It's not clear to me if we start to see more young people flocking to reform, if it becomes more like its American counterpart, whether that could become a significant factor. But generally, there is almost nothing that the British public like more than banning things. They tend to be relatively pro things like smoking bans. On obesity, it's a bit more complicated because they do tend to look at personal responsibility more, but they are more authoritarian in various ways than reform has historically been. I found it very noticeable that strain of reform, which I've always really associated with Nigel Farage, you know, very, very libertarian in many ways, very anti-nanny state, very anti-interference, has been a less visible part of their platform. I find it almost impossible to imagine a party led by Nigel Farage being pro a smoking ban, or pro people not drinking in pubs, or pro people not having a chocolate bar. But I wouldn't be surprised if reform, big if, moves beyond Farage, not clear it can, it became more interventionist in this area.
So many thanks to Rachel for her insights today, and hopefully you'll put that alongside the insights from Luke Trill on the question of public support for the NHS. And we'll be returning to the question of how the main challenger political parties are positioning themselves on the NHS and health more widely over the next few months. So join us on that. Meantime, thanks as ever to Leo and Sean at the Health Foundation, to Paddy and team at Malt Productions. And until next time, it's goodbye from me, Jennifer Dixon.